is the Tactical Nutrition and Performance Podcast. I'm Susan Lopez, Tactical Dietitian, and I am here to help you elevate your performance through better nutrition programming, bridging the gap between knowledge and application to help support the athlete with no off-season. We are going to talk about everything from macros to stress to sleep and more. I will be bringing over a decade of nutrition know-how and experience and introducing you to experts in the tactical performance realm. If you are ready to take your health and performance to the next level and you need information that is relevant and right for you, then you are in the right place. Let's get the show started. Let me tell you about the game changer that I have created for you. The Tactical Nutrition and Performance Database is the center of where I am going to be storing all of my knowledge. I'm going to be teaching all of my nutrition programming. I'm going to be storing all of the tools that I use to coach my personal clients with in this database, and I am going to be making it available to you. So if you want to check it out, make sure you head over to tacticaldietitian.com and enter the membership area. Great thing about this is that I am making it 100% absolutely free for anybody who is in the military, served in the military, or who is a military dependent. So head over there, get your free membership. Even if you're not military or a veteran, you can get a very low-cost membership to get all of my nutrition knowledge at a fraction of the price it would take to be one of my one-on-one clients. And I'm going to be inside the database helping you figure out recipes, meal plans. I'm going to walk you through different webinars. And every month we are going to get together on a live call where you can ask questions. Don't miss out. Take your nutrition programming to the next level and join me inside the Tactical Nutrition and Performance Database. So, Justin, welcome finally to the Tactical Nutrition and Performance Podcast. We talked about having this discussion late last year, and we're finally doing it. And I'm super pumped to have you here and to introduce you to our audience and talk a little bit about what you do over at Tactical Neuroscience. So I'm going to hand it over to you. If you could give us a short introduction to you, what it is that you do, and maybe talk a little bit about the relevance to the tactical community, that would be great.
Yeah, no, thank you so much for having me. This is a wonderful opportunity. And yes, we did have our conversation multiple times late last year, and it's always fun when schedules work out. My name is Justin Smith. I am the founder and CEO of Tactical Neuroscience. It is a kind of idea set, a small bespoke company that grew out of my PhD dissertation. And what I really work on striving to do is provide cutting edge neuroscience information, a lot of it based on the research that I've performed, but just kind of what's happening in the field to those individuals who can use and leverage it in their everyday lives. And so what do I mean by that? That's a lot of what people are asking. What is tactical neuroscience? So we all experience stress. Some individuals experience much more stress than others, depending on their chosen profession, right? So my youngest brother is a police officer. It's extremely stressful job. And when I was doing my PhD research, I was trying to figure out how can I weave in experiments that will generate insights and information that he can then take and apply to his world as a police officer when he has to go through an extremely stressful experience. And so when I say extreme stress, I mean occupations where bullets can be going flying both ways, literally, right? So individuals that may experience a firefight, individuals that may be experiencing life or death scenarios often, or perhaps occasionally inside their career field. And it was pretty fascinating because I was working with animal models, but at the same time, like the overarching understanding of how the stress system works. And once you know how a system works, then you can start to modulate it, right? So understanding how we as human beings perform and can prepare before, during, and after extreme stress events. That's sort of the focus of tactical neuroscience. And also, I get asked often to help with learning and memory types of tasks or program evaluation or training evaluations to help augment those. Because unfortunately, when people usually finally get to the place of calling me, it's because they're doing the same thing they've been doing for 10, 20, or 30, sometimes even 40 years in their training programs. It's a little bit terrifying, right? Like, why in the world would you be doing something for the 1990s? and it's 2022. And so how can we leverage what we know now about learning and memory and also weave in the stress response so that it's optimally tuned when you need to have it working functionally?
And I want to point out that you mentioned, right? So we're talking about like before events, during events, and after events. And I feel like there's a lot of conversations happening right now in the tactical space about mindfulness and like, you know, stress mediation, you know, sleep, all of those things. But I feel like there's not enough conversation about that during time, right? So I want to maybe hit a little bit on all three of those things,
yeah,
right? So maybe let's talk about kind of like the before first. So as we're getting ready to get into these stressful situations, you know, bullets flying at us, running into a burning building, whatever the case may be, what are things that we can do before those situations actually occur to help mitigate, you know, what's going to happen in the event?
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is something where a lot of what I'm going to talk about is it's very easy to say, but it's actually hard to do, and it takes practice, right? And so one of the foundational things when I talk to groups or individuals is recognizing the importance of training. Everybody says, yeah, of course, I train all the time. But as an individual, as you go into that training saying, okay, what can I learn about myself today? What can I learn about the tasks and the skills that I'm looking to practice or acquire? And then how can I make sure that I remember those as most impactfully as possible? And so an example I like to give is, say you're doing an active shooter scenario, your SWAT team does those every other week or every once a month. And it's kind of a, you know, you have the same instructors and you set the scenario up and there's a couple of things that are new and you go through and you do it, everybody does a good job and you're done for the day, right? Whereas if you're getting to that mundane level of training in terms of like you're doing that exciting things over and over again, it's becoming, I don't want to say the word boring, but it's becoming really kind of repetitive. Then it's the idea of saying, this is the pre-part, right? Prepare yourself, say, okay, I'm feeling a little bit like, not lackadaisical is absolutely the wrong word, but just sort of like, okay, let's go do this day of training. Put something in it for yourself, right? What if it's your family member, right? If you need that level of extra kind of oomph to get that level of training to be more applicable to you, or figure out what if it's somebody else's family member, right? Kind of having that idea. And that goes back to the idea of mindfulness a little bit, of being empathy or being empathetic to others, but at the same time, making a long bridge here with these two concepts. But the big deal is practicing mindfulness and practicing empathy will help increase your level of retention during that training that you're going into, which will then increase how you're going to perform during a stressful event, if that makes sense. And so the big thing with training is seeking out those opportunities that push your limits, right? Up to a point where it's not like, you know, super dangerous and unacceptably dangerous. And at the same time, making it so it's impactful for you as an individual, right? If it's super easy for you, that's great. Who can you help on your team that's not super easy for, right? How can you help them get better? And during the pre, you know, event of a stressful encounter, it's the idea of doing everything you can possibly, like when I was playing sports growing up, right? A lot of my coaches saying, leave everything on the field. That way, when you go home at night, win or lose, you know, you played the best you did, you know, the best you could. And it's a similar type of mentality with training where taking those opportunities to really push yourself and be involved and be present in that training when you're doing it. And those are types of things where, again, it's easy to say, but when you're going in and doing it every day, every day, every day, every day, it gets to be hard. And something you have to actually step back, think about, be mindful of, and then practice it.
Yeah, makes total sense. So mindfulness and empathy is super important. So when we're in that training session, can you give us like one or two things that we could do in that training session to practice that mindfulness to keep us in the moment? What is something we can do?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where I would say, I'll give a couple of recommendations, but use whatever works for you. That's a lot of what I try and say too, right? Is there's many different ways to do certain tasks, but practicing the way that you find works for you is really important. And what works for you might change over time too, right? So I'm always looking for, and individuals that are extreme high performers are always looking for, what's somebody else doing that makes them perform well, right? So know what works for you, but also look at what are your colleagues and others in the industry, what are they doing as well? Because, you know, there's always something newer, it gets old and repetitive. So the things to do in my mind are check in with yourself, right? This again sounds really easy to do, but it's how am I doing? How do I feel that I'm doing, right? Do I feel like I'm doing well? Do I feel like I'm not doing well? Have I done a good job or the best job preparing my nutrition and my sleep and rest up to this training? And that's the idea again, too, where, again, sounds really easy, but having a really concise and planned sleep pattern before you have a really intense day of training is super important, right? And again, it's one of those where these are all things that are out there that, you know, it's easy for me to say, but knowing the best way that you fall asleep before you do an intense day of training, even if it's 12, 15, 18 hours before the training begins, that seems like it's two completely uncoupled events, when in reality, you were the same person the night before as you're going to be that next afternoon when you're doing your hostage rescue drills, right? How do you set yourself up for success along those lines? And so I'd say that's one kind of the pre-things. It's like pre things to do, right?
Right. And we know that sleep, right? Or we should know that sleep is going to have a huge impact on your body's ability to make decisions, especially in the moment, right? So if we're talking about marksmanship, accuracy is affected, memory is affected, all of those things are going to be affected if you're in sort of a sleep deprived mode.
Yes, absolutely. Sleep deprivation is a great training tool in terms of you realize how your system functions when it's outside of balance. So I'm using my hands now in case you're listening to the audio of this, right? So I've got both my hands up in front of my face. They're about 2 feet apart from each other. I use this word spectrum a lot, right? So you're going from the left to the right on the spectrum, and where we fall most happily as human beings is somewhere in the middle, what we call homeostasis, right? So as humans, we want to be in or around homeostasis, which means not too hot, not too cold, not too hungry, not too full, right? Rested, but not so rested you're totally lethargic, and also not unrested so that you're just running around having a hard time with sleep deprivation. But we're trying to find where's that happiest place, you know, along our spectrum of performance along homeostasis. The downside of homeostasis is it's really boring, right? I mean, it's truly kind of a boring place to be. So we as humans are constantly saying, let's go out and do an event like a concert, or let's go out with a big group of friends and have a good, you know, enjoyable time at the beach, depending on where we are in the pandemic, social distance or not, right? But just figuring out what is it you can do to kind of get away from having it be this like really mundane, boring, homeostatic existence. We like to do exciting things, rock climbing, you know, skydiving, all these different types of things. We look for those. But setting yourself up so that you can be performing as if you were at homeostasis or even a little bit along the curve one way or the other is really important. The other thing, to kind of go back to the original question of what the other things to practice, is checking in with yourself pre, like so 18, 20 minutes or 18 to 20 hours before the event-ish. And also kind of during the training process, then when you're going through it, right, is saying, again, that moment of like, okay, how am I doing? What is something I can be looking at or practicing or thinking about now? And kind of setting those goals up either right before the training starts or even during the training, especially if it's an unknown scenario, right? Like you're like, okay, we're going to do high risk event. We don't know what it is. And all of a sudden you're like, oh, it's a high risk medical event. I want to make sure I practice putting tourniquets on more than one, right? And saying, okay, I've pre-planned, I know where those are on my persons. I know where my buddies are. Let's make sure we practice or get that skill again honed in, because it's something that you, these individuals do often, right? Like they know how to put a tourniquet on, but making it present in terms of how do you think about, okay, I want to do this as best as possible and practice that even though it's something that's happening inside a stressful event in a training scenario. And that's something where what I'm describing is it, your ability to handle the stressful situation in a training scenario, because that's what it's there for. But also to say, okay, how am I doing? To take that second order step back of it and say, how do I think I'm doing? How is my team doing? Who's doing really well? Where's the new guy or new girl, right? New gal. How are they doing? What can I do to help them, right? And then also making sure that you kind of you're present and you're doing the activity, but at the same time, you're able to kind of step back and think about it and say, okay, what else should I be thinking about, right? What else can I do to keep my hands busy? And again, these are things where when you're getting to this level of training, you know, the skill or the task you're being, you know, the stressful situation you're being asked to handle, you're usually, it's not that stressful anymore, which is why it becomes mundane in often situations. And so that's why it's kind of the idea that my goal is to say, challenge yourself, right? Great. What happens if one of your tourniquets breaks? Where's your third one? right? Who has the third one that's closest to you? Do you have it in a standardized place? Do you know, or do you have a nonverbal hand signal to be able to get that information to somebody else that's close to you, but you can't hear or see them? Sorry, you can't hear them, but you can see them. Those types of things where, again, having somebody that's designing like a training scenario, they don't usually get the time or ability to put those in, but you can do those as yourself if you're trying to make sure you're pushing your limits and pushing your understanding of how you're going to perform under extreme stress.
Yeah, and some of the, definitely some of the high level athletes I've worked with. So like, if we're talking about like medical professionals in the special operations community, one of the things that they do to train is they will often train in the dark, right? When visibility is extremely low. One of the other things that I've seen happen is a lot of times they'll actually cover their hands in kind of like fake blood, right? Yeah. And work with slippery hands. Cause in a combat or a high stress situation like that, where you have to render aid, right? You need to sometimes practice under those conditions. So I know where my equipment is. I know where my tourniquet is, right? So I have that physical awareness of my equipment on the body that if I close my eyes, I can find it, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But now you add in the stress of having slippery hands in the dark, you know, in a real life scenario, if you haven't practiced that, obviously you're not going to be able to perform that to your highest level, right? So that pre work that you've talked about.
Yes.
And then the checking in, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, go. You got it. I'll make it. Yeah, go ahead.
And then the checking in with yourself, right? So if I'm in a training scenario, my assumption is that we're talking about using that check-in to maybe stay present in the moment, right? So
yep.
Physical awareness of equipment, body, personnel, but then also, are we taking into consideration, you know, heart rate, breathing, how I'm reacting to certain types of situations? Would we consider that part of that check-in as well?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the point I was going to make that I got excited about is when you're checking with yourself, again, the big thing is, you know, a lot of times, depending on which group you're working with, but they've been selected, you know, along the way, right? So, you know, you're not super claustrophobic, you know, you're not afraid of heights to a paralyzing amount of, you know, stress, but figure out, and this is the check-in part too, figure out, what of this do I not like, or where am I having a hard time? So again, putting Vaseline or some sort of fake blood all over your hands and say, okay, now figure out how to use all of your gear. That's something you clearly want to do ahead of time, knowing that unfortunately it might be a reality you face in the future. And then also while you're doing it, what I would say is, at what point do you just say, and get so frustrated, right? And recognizing, and it can be almost any task or any situation, but recognizing where you kind of are along that stepwise pathway to say, I know when I get to here, I'm going to lose it, right? And I know if I didn't have breakfast this morning, I'm going to lose it even sooner. And lose it means just get overwhelmingly frustrated, or, you know, at the point where you're having to really slow things down a lot to be able to accomplish the task. Knowing, and this is kind of going back to checking with yourself and being present, is knowing what you're good at, knowing the areas that you have to work on, or your areas of opportunity, especially at this, you know, really elite levels, only you will know that, right? And so that's something where somebody else may or may not be able to recognize that, because you're still passing, you're still doing all the steps necessary, but you can say, you know what, I think I could get better at this part. And I know that because when I was doing it, I was super frustrated. And why was I frustrated? Because I wasn't doing as fast as I wanted it to be going. And that was something that I could certainly try and practice, you know, up to a proficient speed where I'm more comfortable with it, right? Going kind of, you know, transitioning a little bit to the arousal control, right? So understanding how you function, how aroused are you in a stressful situation? There's a really powerful chart, which perhaps you guys have talked about before, but in psychology, it's known as the Yerkes-Dodson law, right? And so on the Y, the vertical axis, you have performance, right? So increasing performance as the graph goes up. And then along the horizontal axis, you have stress. And so the more stressed you are, if you're completely stressed out to the far right-hand side of the graph, your performance goes way down. But also it's a curve, right? So it starts low, goes high, and then comes back down. It's like an inverted U shape is kind of the way to think about it, like a stretched out U. And so if you're not aroused enough, if you're not stressed enough, your performance is also garbage. I describe this usually as if you're falling asleep in a lecture or a class, or you're having a big group meeting and you're the one kind of nodding off, you're not stressed enough, right? The same time too, if you're having an overwhelming stress response, meaning you're having not a panic attack, but in your panic attack, in any situation, your performance is not going to be great. And so what everybody asks or wants to know is, how do I make sure I get to that top of the performance curve with understanding my arousal and my stress response so I can keep it there? And the answer is, it's tough. It's a balancing act, right? It's a wave you kind of want to ride on top of. And when you get to really elite levels, what I like to tell these individuals as well is, recognize you're going to go a little bit past it, but also sometimes you're going to be a little bit before that peak stress curve because you do this all the time. It's not normal to fast rope out of helicopters, but when you're doing it over and over and over again, it seems like it's normal, when in reality, it's not. And so, you know, recognizing like, okay, this should be more stressful to me than it actually is. What can I do? Kind of going back to what we talked about earlier, to make this more real, how can I be mindful? How can I practice this in a more intentional way? That's something where kind of understanding where you are along the arousal spectrum or portion of the curve can be really, really important.
Because it's easy to know. Go ahead. And how could I determine? So if I'm still working on building that skill of kind of finding, you know, that good balance, I mean, could we almost categorize that as almost like a flow state? I mean, how do I go about determining when I'm in that state, especially as I'm in the moment?
Yes. So I'll be a little bit speculative here and a little anecdotal, if that's okay, right? Because I think a lot of the human research along this is, it's okay. It's good. It's not phenomenal. If this was well known, we'd all know it and just practice it and be good at it, right? So what's really interesting is when you hit that kind of what we describe sometimes as a flow state, and you're stressed enough to where you're performing the task efficiently, one of the ways to recognize that as an individual is it seems to go very smoothly and time seems to flow in terms of like, you're not, it doesn't take too long, but it doesn't take too short either. Does that make sense? Right? It doesn't seem like it all happens in an instant eyeball. You can be present enough to know what are the events going on. Where are my teammates? What's going to happen next? What have we just done? You're kind of more aware of that in terms of you're not kind of looking through this like, you know, straw tube. We have to say when you're having an overwhelming stress response and your visual, all your perception goes down to like what's immediately happening in front of you and you have no concept of what's happening at time. And so I think that's also part of it where, again, checking in with yourself, and you could, and we can do this through, you know, heart rate monitors, heart rate variability. It's different biofeedback mechanisms to look at it, but at the same time, just saying, how am I feeling right now? Like, am I present enough to where I'm excited? And I want to be doing, you know, what I'm doing is appropriate versus like, oh yeah, we got to do this thing. And then somebody's going to do this and then they're going to do this next event. And then I'm going to go in, but it's kind of in that more of a less stressed attitude or way, right? Yeah. That's kind of, again, it's how I describe it to individuals that do this often is, you know, the 10 steps that are going to happen in a breaching event, right? You've done it over and over again in the daytime, at nighttime, under night vision. You know, it's still stressful because you're carrying, when it's live, you know, live explosives on you. But at the same time, you know those steps, right? That means you're probably on the, I would say, the left-hand side of that stress arousal curve. And then the idea is with making it so it's not overwhelmingly dangerous, right? How do you make it so it's more relevant to you? Pretend your family member's in there. That'll get your heart rate up. That'll definitely make it so it's much more real to you. Pretend it's your friend's family member, your teammate's family member who's in there that you're going to go practice rescuing, right? Those are the types of things where if you're on the, and again, the more elite the groups, the further along the stressed continuum to the left they get usually, where they're not stressed enough. And not to say that's always bad. I think that's another very important thing to talk about when we talk about physiological systems. You want to make sure you're spinning those systems up, but you're also ramping them back down so you kind of get to that rest, relaxation, recuperation phase. But it's easy to know when you're falling asleep in class. It's also easy to know when you're panicking or like freaking out and you don't know which direction you're supposed to go or where your team went because you're having overwhelming stress response. It's trying to find that top of the curve in the middle, right? And when you get there, a lot of times things happen so smoothly, you don't realize it until afterwards, but checking in with yourself can kind of help you monitor and say like, yeah, this is going really well. Like, yeah. Oh my gosh, we're handling this really well. Like this is going incredibly smoothly. This seems weird, but when it happens and it flows, it's beautiful. And that's something where, you know, again, talking to friends and colleagues and individuals I've worked with, when it happens, it's almost like it was so easy. That's kind of how they describe the situations in real life when the event, you know, occurs. Like everything went, you know, really smoothly. And were able to, you know, do all of the stuff we were supposed to do. And it was great. It's kind of how they describe it. So that's sort of, again, that optimal state that you want to be in, that's hard to kind of maintain or to get to, but.
Yeah. And I would say, could we also say kind of like what we're saying is when we're in that high stress state, right? You start to experience that tunnel vision and it makes you less aware of what's going on around you. And you're kind of hyper-focused maybe on one thing, which is going to leave you open and vulnerable to, let's just say, attacks from any other portion that you're not looking for, any other area that you're not looking from, right?
Yep.
And then kind of practicing those physical things we discussed, right, in the pre-pre, practicing those, that muscle memory, that mental muscle memory, maybe. And if I'm using terminology that doesn't really make sense, obviously this is not my area of expertise, so feel free to correct me. But so practicing the physical, the mental states, you know, getting a decent amount of exposure to those high stress situations, and then being able to, in the moment, check in with yourself, right? So that's kind of what I'm hearing. Does that sound accurate?
It does. It does. And one of the points I'd like to make is a lot of times these events sort of fall into two different categories, and one category is really distinct and you know it. Like what I like to call kind of the car crash analogy. You're driving along just fine, and then somebody T-bones you. That's a super stressful event that you really didn't have very much control over, potentially, and it happens in an instant. Whereas you come upon a scene of a car that's on fire where somebody has been T-boned, right? And you have to then help or render aid or, you know, make a phone call. That's also an extremely stressful event, but it's a prolonged event. Does that make sense? That event occurs over minutes, or hopefully not hours, but a longer duration of time. Whereas some of those really stressful events can happen in an instant. And then it all depends on what you've done beforehand for your training. And then what you know, how you deal with it afterwards, kind of in the post portion of it. But, you know, the specifics I'm talking about, like checking with yourself, those kind of are those, you know, minutes to longer types of stressful events where the actions that you have beyond like your fight or flight, you know, initial jerk reaction can help with the situation. And then to go back to the pre portion, right, with those events that happen in an instant, individuals that practice really self-awareness and situational awareness do a really good job. Light turns green at the intersection. They look one more time both ways before they pull through, right? Or somebody's texting, light goes green, they just hit the gas and go. That's when T-bones happen. Not to say that, again, they're always avoidable. Unfortunately, I'm knocking on wood because nobody wants to be T-boned. But at the same time, you know, trying to set yourself up for success and knowing where the potential risks are, that's another thing to practice before you get into those extreme stress.
Yeah, and I would, that probably has a lot to do with experience as well, I would imagine.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. So now that we've kind of determined what we need to do maybe in the moment, let's really talk about sort of the, can we call it down regulation that maybe has to occur afterwards, or maybe what do we need to do to mitigate any issues that might arise after a serious event, regardless of how long the event is?
Absolutely. So this is something that, again, sounds super easy, but it's something that not always individuals recognize or practice, is just acknowledging that was super stressful, right? Like that was a stressful event. Like that did not go as planned. And it was way more stressful than I thought it would be. I need to put a marker in that and say that is something that will affect me for a long time, right? How do I think about processing through that? And again, even not to be too pointed, but to use the example of firefights, my friends and, you know, people I've worked with that have gone downrange and been in many, many different firefights, they're not all the same. And they're often very different. And being able to say, this one was really bad. It was bad for these reasons. And this is what we could have done better to learn from it. But at the same time, just marking that and saying, this was an event that, you know, I may need to keep track of in my well-being overall 1 year from now, 5 years from now, 40 years from now, to kind of figure out how am I going to deal with that. The other part too, and I want to put a big caveat in here. So my degree is in research. So I'm a PhD. I'm not a medical doctor, right? And so the other part that I like to say is it's becoming less, but there still is a stigma on mental health, right? And if you need professional mental health, please seek that out. There's phenomenal individuals who work with all different types of people and, you know, are able to help beyond the idea of like, here, take this pill, right? So that's the part two, is if you've experienced an overwhelming extreme stress event and you're still dealing with those consequences in what I would argue is a non-healthy way, right? So to the extreme self-harm behavior, you know, you like to skydive occasionally, now you're skydiving twice a day because you have to stay alive, right? You have to feel normal. That's when you want to see somebody professionally. Totally okay. But the idea of how to kind of recognize what's happening is just, again, it sounds really easy. Check in with yourself. Am I drinking more than normal? Alcohol, right? Am I drinking more coffee than I was before? Abnormally? Am I sleeping way more or way less, right? Are you adjusting? Have you adjusted and shifted your state of well-being? Are you working out way more than you were before or way less, right? How is your mood? Those types of things. And then again, recognizing is kind of that first moment. And especially if it's been, you know, a couple of years or longer, you'd be like, I don't know, like, everything's weird. Like, I just don't really feel like, you can kind of get to that lethargic phase. And that's the part where saying, oh yeah, there was that really bad experience that I had, and kind of be able to go back and then saying, how do I want to deal with this? Right. And that's kind of the idea of, again, if you need professional help, please seek that out on how to kind of quote unquote deal or work through a process through that information. And from my portion, what I say with, you know, under the guise of tactical neuroscience and the hat there, is the idea that understanding that events can have you could have the same event and different people can have a completely different outcome, right? Meaning you can be totally fine after a extreme stress event and your person who's literally right next to you who had the exact same outcome, meaning you guys both walked away and, you know, got back to base, it's fine. That person can have an overwhelming stress response that's completely deleterious or affects them greatly for a long time to go. And what's fascinating, and this is kind of a side anecdote I like to bring into conversations, is the physiological stress response that we have, right? So the HPA axis, you know, autonomic nervous response that dumps epinephrine in our body, physiologically, right? That is the exact same, but how you perceive how the event goes is completely dependent on the context of what's happening. Meaning, if you go to pick up your favorite person in the world from the airport, right? And you're waiting for them as they're getting ready to come out of the arrival section. Your hands are nervous, right? You're kind of a little sweaty. You're kind of excited. Yeah. You're pumped. This is somebody that you care about deeply, perhaps most deeply in the world. You haven't seen them in a while. You're going to get people in the airport. That's a stress response, right? This is the cool part. That stress response is exactly the same physiologically as if you're out in the woods, you're picking blueberries, you're having a great afternoon on a Sunday, you're eating blueberries, you're picking blueberries, you're thinking about how great blueberry jams can be later, and all of a sudden a bear comes around the corner of a tree and stares right at you, right? Your body goes into the same physiological response as you experience you're picking your loved one up from the airport, except now this bear wants those berries too, right? It's a dangerous place for you to be. And you have to figure out how to get out of that situation. And so that's the part where, going back to the firefight example, right, where one individual leaves and is totally normal and fine, the other individual leaves and is like, that, you know, has really negative outcomes. It's all what's happening inside that individual. So maybe the person that had the bad experience was thinking about, you know, mortality a lot before they went on that mission. Maybe they were just had somebody else, you know, passed away recently in their life. And so it was something different between those two individuals. Even though the experience was the same, you can have these completely different outcomes. And so I think that's either part two, post-event, recognizing even the people you might talk to that were there with you during that experience, they might be having a totally different experience than you are. And how do you deal with that, right? And that's the big part too, where individuals that experience, especially in small groups or in groups, extreme stress, being able to share that again, even though they might not have the same outcome from both sides, is really important. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is a really important part. And I think that especially if you're someone who is instructing or in a leadership position or in that position of mentorship, maybe have more experience on the team, understanding that individual resiliency maybe,
yep,
or individual experience, at least having respect for it, is super important, right? Because I will say that working sometimes with military athletes, for instance, there's just kind of this mentality of, hey, suck it up, you know, be tough, get over it, you know, move on. But being able to understand that everybody's going to react to those stressful situations differently And everybody's going to have a different level of being able to cope with them, right? Yep. So I think that's important. So I think as a leader, I think, you know, people should take away from that, hey, not everybody is you, and you can't make everybody be you. So as a leader or a mentor, right, understanding that your experience in that situation is not the same as everybody else's, I think that's really important.
Yeah, I agree. And I would also add, this kind of, again, ties it back to what we were talking about earlier, is as a leader, practicing mindfulness outside of it being yoga or meditation or something along those lines of saying, what is this person that I'm mentoring? What potentially are they experiencing? And then the idea, this is hard to do, especially in different contexts or different, you know, job fields, is be vulnerable, share your experience, right? I remember this, I'm still working through this part, right? This was an event that happened to me, and you shared in a very, you know, an appropriate environment. And this is how I'm dealing with it in what I believe is a healthy way. How do I do it as a leader, and asking the person, you know, that you're working with or mentoring, saying, you know, this, if this hasn't happened, that's okay. It probably will at some point, right? And just recognizing,
empathy, right?
That's, yeah, empathy. It is totally. And again, these are super, super easy things to say, but to practice them takes effort. And I think that's the part of it where, it's if it was easy, it'd be done now. I like to say that as well, right? So it takes thoughtfulness and effort and practice to become honed and optimize, you know, your own performance. And I think at the end of the day, if you're in a job field where your life depends on your behavior and also your teammates' behavior, I want to make sure that I'm bringing my best self to work every day.
Yeah, and my personal opinion, just again, because I'm not an expert in this field, right, is I feel like you have to have a certain level of self-awareness, which can be difficult for some people to be able to sit down and see where your shortcomings are, not only with some of the job aspects that you talked about earlier, but just like individual personality characteristics,
yes,
that may also be an issue or a barrier to you doing your job appropriately, right? And building that level of empathy. Would you say that that's?
I would, and this is something, I say this lightly, but it's a very powerful tool to use, is especially in between guys, right? Between two males. And you say, hey man, how you doing? How you feeling? I feel good, my shoulders are sore. I lifted shoulders yesterday, you know, but got legs tomorrow. I'll probably be good for that. I'm gonna have a good dinner and make sure I get rested. And then you say, no, like emotionally, how are you feeling? And I can tell you what, as a guy, when somebody asks me, I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm good. And like, really? I'm like, well, actually, nah, I'm not. Here's why, or I'm a little down because of this, or I'm feeling great because, you know, this person I was gonna talk to about this promotion, I actually got a hold of them and I think the conversation went well. But as males, especially in our culture and our society, we don't do that. How are you feeling means how are you feeling physically, right? Not how are you feeling emotionally? How are you feeling well-being wise? And when you ask them that, again, if when it's done in a very meaningful way, it could be really powerful, right? And so, especially if you know somebody that has been through an extreme stress event, check in with them. Pick them up, you know, go grab a coffee, right? Go say, hey man, I got 15, 20 minutes. You want to go for a quick walk? Nothing crazy. I'm like, oh, well, that seems weird, but yeah, okay. Not so it's like a job evaluation type of walk, but like a, hey, I just want to go outside. Let's go check this out. You know, this small event's happening. You want to come with us? It'd be fantastic. And then when you're on the way there, on the way back, kind of weave in, how you feeling? Good. Emotionally. Oh, because then you have to open up, practice vulnerability on both sides. And it's pretty powerful, again, because, in our culture, women do this often, right? Like, well, how are you feeling? Did you talk about your feelings? The answer with guys is no, we never talk about our feelings at all. It's not part of our normal well-being. But it can have really nice and beneficial outcomes for sure, especially after extreme stress events, for sure.
Absolutely. And then, you know, not having that outlet. So talking about seeking help from professionals, excuse me.
Yeah.
And then, you know, just having that support system. But if we're talking about, you know, there's individuals who are just sort of doing that bottling up of emotions, experience, putting on the tough face, you know, what are some of the long-term detriments to that type of behavior?
Yeah. So they're not good. I also start by being very pointed. Dealing with long-term stress without it being, dealing with, without recognizing and you know, healthily figuring out how to work through, you know, long-term stress, it can be really hard. And so what I like to share with individuals is, if you're in a high stress career field, one, recognize that. And then two, it's really easy to look around. People have been doing it for 5, 10, 15, 20 years and say, what's the deal with these individuals, right? Well, often times with individuals that are doing a career for a long, long time, their work performance might be fantastic, but their home life is not so red hot. They probably consume a little bit too much alcohol in inappropriate times, potentially. And their relationships with others are usually, again, okay, not great, right? Not everybody, but you can definitely clearly pick out to say, this person's a great team member. They're not doing so hot when they take off the uniform, right? How can you, and then seeing that, recognizing it, okay, how do I make sure I'm able to perform as best as I can and then not become that person? Not in like a negative way, like they're, you know, totally life's in shambles, but just to say, I want to be healthy when I retire, mentally and physically. How can I think about that and set yourself on that kind of 15, 20 year path, especially if you're really young and coming into it? How do I make sure I can be, you know, successful in my next endeavor in life, right? And so stress specifically, especially when you know you're going to be experiencing these extreme stress events, is figure out what are those people that are crushing it that you see that are doing really well, right? What are some of the tips and tricks that they have? Find those mentors, seek them out and say, how do you do this? Or even more pointedly, tell me about a time you had a really hard time with that you still think about, right? And how do you deal with that? And often what you hear is, somebody to say that's been doing it for a long time is, you know, I had a good friend, they passed away for this reason, you know, in the line of duty or whatever, they passed away during their job function. And when I think about him, I take a moment, I think about him, then I go for a 20 or 30 minute run, right? And I go outside, I exercise. If that's not appropriate, I take it, I save that. And the next morning when I'm working out, I do a couple of sets and I think about him. Right. So I practice that idea of remembering that individual, remembering the good times, not focusing on the moment that they, you know, that the really negative event happened, but just sort of practicing that idea of, I want to celebrate this person and think about them just for me. Right. And that's a technique. I'm sure there's a cognitive psychology name for this, what I'm describing, but the idea from physiological state is it brings up that pathway in your long-term memory. And what you're doing is you're rewiring your neuroplasticity associated with that individual so that it goes away from being completely aligned with that negative event to when that cue, is what we call neuroscience, when that cue arrives, your brain says, oh yeah, I'm really sad they're no longer here. But I remember when we went to that beach and had a cool bonfire, and then we saw that car slip out of gear and go down the beach, and the people, you know, you kind of have some fun event associated with an event that the guys experienced together. Those can be really, really impactful and really important. And the other part is making sure that you're able to cycle on and cycle off, right? Know when you need to be at the peak part of your stress curve. Know when it's okay to say, we're good here. I'm not going to stress about this. This is paperwork and it'll take care of itself. It's that, you know, it may or may not be outside of my control, but I'm not going to worry about it. Like, learn to not stress the small stuff, I think, is the simplest way to say it. And individuals that have really long careers in these super high stress situations or environments or occupations, they get really good at that. like, hey man, this is due tomorrow. Okay, we're going to figure it out. It'll take 20 minutes. I'll work on it when I work on it. But right now I'm doing this. Oh, well, they don't seem that, you know, and they get it done. That's the part too. They're not procrastinating, but being able to recognize where you are and where you need to be for what you're being asked to do. And I think that's a little bit tricky to say or to think about, but it's people that are really good at having, you know, long-term stress management, figure out they recognize when they're too stressed, and they know mitigation practices they can use to decrease their stress. One of the biggest ones, you know, I like to talk about is exercise, voluntary exercise. It has to be voluntary. That's very key. Voluntary exercise where you say, you know what, I am going to go for a run because I want to. And what you find after you do some exercise, physical activity, anything gets your heart elevated, right? So I use running because it's easy, but it could be swimming, could be lifting weights, could be whatever it is that gets you like across, whatever it is you want to go do that's fun, it's physical activity, voluntarily. It's one of the most powerful stress reducing behaviors that we can do as individuals. It's incredible, to be honest. It's amazing how powerful exercise is as a stress mitigating factor.
Is there a point where utilizing exercise as something to de-stress becomes negative.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, if somebody is dealing with a stressful event, well, I'll give you an example. So
yes.
A thing I hear a lot of times is I'll ask individuals, even when they're coming to me for nutrition advice, one of the things I always ask about is their daily level of stress. You know, how are you experiencing stress? What are you doing to mitigate that stress, especially when it's at such a high level? And mm-hmm. a common response I get is, well, I just go to the gym and crush it. I kill myself at the gym. I go for a 10-mile run, right? Which again, isn't necessarily a bad thing, but how do we assess when we get to that point where exercise is becoming more dangerous to what's going on with our mental health, our physical health, in sort of that realm that we're talking in today? How do we determine when exercise is no longer being beneficial when used in that capacity?
Yes, great question. And so it's the way to think about it is, are you doing the exercise to a point where you're pushing yourself up to, you know, where you're having a really beneficial session, let's say, right? Say if lifting weights, or are you going into lift weights every day and saying, today, again, I'm going to set a new personal record, right? And that's how you know you have a good day in the gym, is you're saying a PR every time you go in. Well, anybody who lifts weights and be like, dude, that's not the way to do, you're going to injure yourself, right? And so I think one of the ways, again, to check in is saying, how often am I injured? And am I working out to the place where I'm destroying my body for a very short-term gain versus looking at it for a longer-term sustainable type of use, right? And so I use the example again. I have a lot of friends who like to run marathons, and we're all now entering middle age. And it turns out a few of my friends are totally destroyed, and they've ruined their knees and their bodies because they just kept signing up for marathons over and over again. And it's the idea of like, that's great. I'm super happy you're able to run 26 miles in the time that you set for yourself. But you train, and maybe half the time or more, you don't ever get to run the race because you're injured, right? That means you're doing too much, I think, is a way to be very pointed about it. And if you're using it as again, depending on the population we're talking about, I think this population has a higher probability of falling into this category of using exercise to a really near harmful level to cope with the stress. That could be something that can be evident in this community, basically. And so recognizing where are your limits, right? A great example I think I was working with, and one of the individuals is like, look, I could tell Michael Phelps, I can break Michael Phelps. I could just say, hey man, go hold your breath for 10 minutes. You'd die, because you can't do it, right? But can you hold your breath for 2.5 minutes if you practice up 3 minutes? Probably. But you don't just start with somebody and say, okay, go hold your breath for 10 minutes, right? That's very clearly not probabilistic. And, you know, theoretically, maybe somebody could do that, but it's not healthy for 99% of the population, right? To go out and try and do that. And so recognizing, maybe I am using exercise as an extreme coping mechanism. What are some of the other things that you can do? And to not be too prescriptive, but what I've seen work for those individuals is they're so used to going and running at this really high rate of speed, right? Like go, 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 things are happening. I got to be, they're hyper-organized often, right? So everything's color-coded. They've got a binder for it. They're, you know, everything's set. Is to do something that's on the other end, to practice, to check in with yourself, to say, how do I slow this down? How do I kick off like my parasympathetic nervous system, right? How do I work on my, not just breathing and breath control so I can lower my heart rate, but how do I do it so that I feel the best, right? And these are things that, again, sound really easy to do, but can be kind of hard to practice because you don't always know what they are. A lot of times knitting can be really, because it's still a tactful event. And at the same time, it doesn't take a ton of concentration. So you're not using a lot of cognitive resources, but you're able to do these patterns. And people find that, you know, when they build in X amount of minutes or hours knitting a week or a month, they feel better. And that's something where, again, whatever works for you is what I recommend figuring out and trying new things. That's also part of it. Be a lifelong learner. Be okay with being bad at something.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's good for the brain, right? It helps create new connections.
Yeah.
Right. So focusing,
You know, when an event happens, a negative event that you're trying to deal with, right? We don't focus on the event itself, maybe acknowledge that it happens, but then we're focusing on the positive.
Yep.
Finding those things that are going to help with regulation of sympathetic versus parasympathetic. So sympathetic being your heightened arousal system, we'll call it, and then your parasympathetic being that system that helps bring you down, perhaps back to baseline. So parasympathetic activities being things that keep your mind occupied, keep your hands busy, it sounds like. I know one of the things that helps me just as a non, you know, operator, right? Just in my day-to-day life is just quiet. There's so much noise in the world from phones, from people, from TVs, from, especially right now, the world is chaotic, right?
Yep.
There's just so much noise that happens. I know for me personally, and even for my spouse, just not having that noise around can sometimes be beneficial, right? So turning off the TV, putting your phone on do not disturb, you know, just sitting in the quiet. I'm always shocked by how many people just can't stand to be in the quiet.
Yeah.
That is crazy to me. You know, so that's just kind of my personal anecdote is just, you know, when was the last time you sat down and ate your meal, right? I'm a dietitian. When's the last time you sat down and ate your meal and there was nothing happening around you except the sound of you chewing?
Yeah. Yeah.
So,
and practicing it, right? I think that's the other big thing to point out is it's not something that you're going to be really good at right away. Right. So practice it. And so I like to tell people is, you know, what we're good at as human beings is setting up and saying we like goals. So practice a minute or practice even 30 seconds, right? Practice 2 minutes of sitting quietly without doing too much. And what you find is our brains have these, we like to refer to as kind of the default mode network, meaning how often are certain parts of your brain firing? What's the normal state of affairs? What's your kind of baseline for going through life, right? Today, because we have all these different technologies that are bombarding us, like I'm wearing a headset with a microphone, I have my phone near me, I've got, you know, two computers in front of me as well. So there's all these alerts happening all the time. And I'm constantly listening for my kids in the background to see if the movie that I've got them watching is over, right? So there's all this stuff happening, but practicing, you know, limiting that to just what's around you in the present moment for a short duration of time, your default mode network doesn't know what to do because that's not our normal. So it's like, I need to have my phone near me because I need to know if somebody's going to try and get a hold of me for an important reason. If it's important and it's not life or death, they can wait 2 minutes, right? So start there. Airplane mode for phone, set the timer for 2 minutes, put the phone out of arm's reach, right? Ideally in like a different room, you can still hear it when the alarm goes off. And then practice that idea of mindfulness or breathing. And it doesn't have to be these long, long durations of time to see these benefits. You know, you can start to retrain yourself to just practice being calm and relaxed in short segments. And then this is the cool part from my perspective is when you get good at practicing that, especially if you know you're going into a stressful event, you can leverage those techniques as you're going in, right? It's a helicopter ride in, the van ride in, as things are happening. I just practiced it recently. Giant medical emergency. Thankfully, it was with a dog, not a human, but there was blood everywhere. And as I'm parking my motorcycle, I said, okay, this is going to be stressful. I like dogs a lot. This is not going very well for the dog that got attacked. And I took some deep breaths. I calmed myself down. I checked for traffic before I jogged across the street, right? Things that again, seemed totally normal, but I wanted to make sure I was aware of and ready to go when I got to the event because it was not good. And
well, that makes a lot of sense. If you aren't practicing it when stress isn't high, I mean, how could you possibly put those things into practice during a stressful event? And I mean, that I feel like that makes a lot of sense, right? It's common sense. So now let me ask you this question. So let's say I've been operating in the tactical space for 15, 20 years, right? And that curve that you spoke about earlier, right? What if I'm on the far end of that curve where I'm now not responding to stressful events when I know that I should be responding, right? So there's a lot of things coming out now about allostatic load. You even hear kind of the term operator syndrome occasionally. you know, talking about the different things that happen once you've kind of reached that maximum. And now you have a situation where there's other biochemical things happening that aren't allowing you to respond to that load. We don't necessarily have to get too deep into that today.
Yeah.
But how do I know when I'm experiencing a situation where I'm not responding appropriately, such as that? And what are some maybe steps I need to take to help me get back into that peak of that curve?
Yeah, great, great questions. And I think part of this is for individuals that operate at really, really high stress as their normal. And I say stress, not so much stress to them, but stress in the situations they're dealing with, right? And usually these people are really good at dealing with those situations and they perform very well. And then recognizing that that is not normal, which you've been doing it for a career, it gets to be normal. But in reality, for everybody else that's not doing that job, that is not normal at all. And recognizing that that is a portion of what your existence is about, but then you have to come back to normal with everybody else, right? And that's a really hard thing to do in terms of the reason why individuals select to go to those career paths. So they want to do cool stuff. They want to do the hardest things, right? They're challenging, they're individuals that want to challenge themselves and be with the most elite group that they can be with, essentially. And then you say, okay, you've been running at this super high level for such a long time. Hypervigilance is a great example, right? So you see people, individuals discuss driving down the roadway and somebody cuts them off and they go this, like this really overwhelming response of like, you know, a tactical driving situation where they're worried about getting, you know, an ambush or a carjack. And it's like, no, that's just a mom late for school, dropping her kids off in a minivan to cut you off, right? So decoupling those is really hard to do because it's based on that individual's experience for many years in a row. And so what happens as human beings, especially in the neuroscience perspective, neurochemical perspective, you get these systems that are used to being flipped on really quickly that save your life, right? So it's hyper-awareness, what else is happening? What's going on around me? Where is everybody that I should know where they are? And then recognizing, and again, to the context of the situation, what's happening in the external environment. Okay, this probably isn't an ambush. It's a woman who is driving her minivan, who was texting and trying to get her, you know, kids to school, wherever they're doing, whatever's happening, who cut you off. Easy to say, hard to do, because you've been training your body for a number of years in a row to have this appropriate response for certain context situations versus, you know, quote unquote, everyday normal life. And the thing that's really hard about it is practicing that. And then also when I get to work with those individuals and groups, what I tell them is find something that's super challenging that you're not good at all that helps to mimic that response. And one of the ways, this is really fun in my mind, one of the ways we can do that is through public speaking, because most people don't like public speaking at all. But again, going back to that, the physiological response is the same if you're facing the bear in the woods or you're picking up your loved one at the airport. Public speaking in front of a small, strange audience, right? Or I gave this example and people thought I was kidding. I am not good at poetry writing whatsoever. Like, I'm a horrible person that writes poetry. Yet, I wanted to make sure that I was able to get up and bomb. And so I wrote a poem and went to a poetry open mic night and read my poem. It was horrible. Like, it was not good for anybody in the audience. I didn't like it at all, but I wanted to practice and make sure I knew what that feeling felt like so I could deal with it before, during, and after, right? And so that's the idea, where don't go and bomb at open mic nights, but at the same time, find a place where you can practice elevating your stress response like you have for your career in a healthy and, I would say, non-high-risk environment, right? And that's why I got friends that jump out of airplanes often, and they're like, we have to jump out of airplane with a wingsuit. And then one of the guys, it was pretty funny. He didn't tell me in this, you know, with this angle in mind, but he's like, I totally get why guys die with wingsuits on all the time. Because flying in a wingsuit over, you know, at high altitude, super, he goes, it's cool, but it's super boring. He goes, you want to go feel fast. And he goes, you want to go down a mountain. I was like, dude, he was like, yeah, I had to recognize I shouldn't do this, because he goes, I know myself. And I'd be like, yeah, let's go jump out in the Alps and like buzz your Red Bull style. He's like, I totally get why this has such a high fatality rate, because it's way more fun to do that than it is just to fly around at high altitudes, you know, forever in a wingsuit. But figuring out what are those things that are able to, I wouldn't say even mimic, but kind of get close to those experiences that you had in terms of your physiological stress response outside of that context of being in an extreme stress event. Does that make sense?
I think it's No, it was great. So, talking about, you know, mimicking the stress event, right? So you still have to experience that stress, but now it sounds like as you're experiencing that stress in a non-threatening environment, you're sort of reteaching yourself how to respond appropriately.
Yep. Yeah, okay. Exactly. Yeah. It's literally, to put a point, you're retraining your brain to recognize this is appropriate, right? This is how I should respond, and doing it in a way that's beneficial and beneficial for you and to others. That's kind of the best case scenario, right? Versus like going from being in a high stress occupation and then becoming an ultra marathon runner. Like you can do that for a number of years and then your hips and knees are going to just be destroyed. And 6 years later, you're like, well, I was an ultra marathon runner. Now what do? I go bomb an open poetry nights, right? It's like, okay.
Yeah. So getting comfortable with being uncomfortable again.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Which is, as you go through, and this is the other point I want to make to you, as you go through a career in these really, you know, high level, high stress occupations, it gets really hard to put yourself back out there to be uncomfortable because you're used to being physically uncomfortable. And this is the challenge I like to tell people. They're like, yeah, okay, used to be physical, but go and be vulnerable in other ways, right? Go be uncomfortable.
Vulnerable is a great word. You read my mind. Okay. Vulnerability is hard.
It is hard.
It's extremely hard.
Yeah.
But that makes a lot of sense. And I think, again, you know, like that whole talking to someone, figuring it out, checking in with someone, right? That vulnerability, it's really hard for this community because we don't want to feel weak, right? Yep. We don't want to be perceived as weak.
Yep.
But I think understanding that vulnerability is quite the opposite, I think is extremely important.
Correct. And when practiced appropriately, what I tell to my friends and individuals I get to work with is that when practiced appropriately, you'll find your performance goes up. And that's what you want to do at the end of the day anyways, right? So that's the end goal measure of success is how do you operate? How do you feel? How do you perform better? And it turns out adding a sprinkle of vulnerability in there and your performance goes up because you're less stressed. You're not worried about the small stuff. You're able to perform when you need to and get those things out of the way that need to be done that shouldn't be stressful.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. I totally agree with all of that. So this has been phenomenal. This has been probably one of the best discussions around this topic I think I've ever had. So I definitely want to do it again at some point. I would love to reconnect with you so we can maybe dive a little bit deeper into some of the other topics.
Yeah, yeah.
If that sounds good to you.
Absolutely. No, thank you.
But I'd love to let people know how to find you, how to reach out to you. What's the best way to also learn a little bit more? So how can people find you, Justin?
Yeah, absolutely. So my website is tacticalneuro.com. The science portion got lopped off. So just tacticalneuro.com. And also, there's the list of the podcasts that I've been on, understanding the level of work through interviews. I will say a lot of what I get to work on professionally when I'm engaged at that level, I sign an NDA. So it's like, I use these very unfortunate generic examples. And so some of the, you know, hopefully it wasn't bad, right? But it's like, I can't say exactly what it is, but the amount of information that comes out through podcasts, I think, is very good. It's a little bit of a long form way to consume it, but it's also hopefully enjoyable. So tacticalneuro.com. And then also on social media, Instagram specifically is where I check the most, is Tactical Neuroscience or at Tactical Neuroscience. And I answer all my DMs and feel free to send me, there's a contact page on the website. If you want to engage that way or have a question for me, I love having conversations. And so please feel free to reach out. I think that's something too, where, I don't know if you could tell, I like talking to people. So
yeah, we always have great conversations. So yeah. I love it. So we'll make sure all that information is linked in the show notes. So if you guys want to reach out, you can. So grateful that you were able to be here with us today. And I look forward to speaking again soon.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You bet. Thanks, Justin.